What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I have got a really great episode that I've been wanting to share. This was about a month ago. I was on the Swan Signal Live podcast on YouTube with Brady Swenson, which I know a lot of you guys know him. He's from Swan Bitcoin, runs so much of their stuff over there, and the Citizen Bitcoin podcast. And of course, Peter Todd, who is a really influential and long-time Bitcoin developer. But I got a lot of great comments about this one, and this one's specifically good for people, I think, who have only arrived to Bitcoin in recent years. We basically take a walk through Bitcoin history. You know, what was it like at the beginning of all this insanity? The battles that we had along the way, and then the decisions and challenges that got us to where we are now. Like, why is Bitcoin what it is, and how did we get here? So, just a short little introduction. I'm just gonna let Brady take it over from here. This is the Swan Signal Live podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll be back tomorrow with another episode of Bitcoin Audible.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 47 of Swan Signal Live. We have a really fun episode. I'm really looking forward to this one with Peter Todd and Guy Swan. We're going to dive into Bitcoin's fascinating history, and I'm, like I said, very excited about it. This episode and this whole show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, and it's simply the best way to accumulate Bitcoin in the United States. We are iterating quickly on the product, and we have a lot of improvements coming out, at a rapid pace right now. Jan Pritzker and his team are increasingly accomplishing our goals of making this the easiest and fastest way to go from zero to Bitcoin. And not only that, also the best way to accumulate Bitcoin in the United States. You can get paid in Bitcoin. Think about this as a regular way to accumulate an asset, like you might a 401k or a mortgage payment steadily every month. And you can think about it as getting paid in Bitcoin. Pick a percentage of your income every month and, you know, set that as the amount of Bitcoin you'd like to buy. We'll pull that directly from your bank account automatically. We'll automatically convert it to Bitcoin. And then you can actually automatically withdraw it as well. You'll just get an email to confirm the withdrawal once you reach a certain threshold. So automatic withdrawals are pretty sweet. And we will, you know, you can take your time until you're ready. We'll help you, move along that process, understand when it's a good idea to take your keys, take control of your private keys. And we try to follow those Bitcoin best practices as closely as we can. We are in a bit of a dip right now, but Swan customers, members are have strong hands, are buying this dip in earnest. And it's really great to see. We're seeing big wires come in to make big purchases to kind of stack on this dip. We can take wires from $10,000 up to $10 million. So if you're on that GigaChad level, we're happy to assist you and are able to do that. We have also set up Swan Treasury. This is kind of the new wave that was kicked off by GigaChad, Michael Saylor at MicroStrategy. And more and more companies are accumulating Bitcoin with Swan, moving their treasuries over to a Bitcoin standard. So you can email us at treasury@swanbitcoin.com, and we'll give you a hand on that front. Again, we are a Bitcoin-only company, which means we're a lean operation. We don't have to support a bunch of altcoins from our engineering or support departments. And that means we can offer lower fees. We are 60 to 80% lower than Coinbase. So really no reason to be on Coinbase. Most people don't want to play those altcoin casinos anyway. We're trying to move people out of that idea, and just move them, you know, to Bitcoin only at Swan. And another thing that I really love about Swan is that our marketing is education. A big part of that effort is this show, Swan Signal Live. And today we have Peter Todd and Guy Swan with us for episode 47. Again, we're going to dive into Bitcoin history. So this should be a lot of fun. One more thing. Please like the video so we can get out there on the YouTube feed, help make this Bitcoin-only education more visible. All right. We have today with us Peter Todd. He is, Brecky, can you go ahead and bring up our guest? There we go. We have with us today Peter Todd. He's a Bitcoin developer, and he was discussing digital cash on the Cypherpunk mailing list with Hal Finney himself way back in 2001. So we are fortunate to have Peter here with us today, as he is one of the most qualified people in the space to discuss the topic at hand. Peter, thanks for your time today and welcome to the show, man.
Thank you.
And we have Guy Swan. He's host of the popular Bitcoin Audible podcast. In my opinion, one of the most valuable education resources in the space. He reads the best Bitcoin articles and essays, so you don't have to. And then he delivers hot takes and inspiring rants after he reads them. It's great stuff. He's been around since early 2011, so he's also a very early adopter of Bitcoin and knows very well its history. Guy, welcome to the show, man. Glad to have you.
Yeah, man. As always, good to be back.
All right, so we're going to start with Bitcoin's prehistory. Now, you know, digital money had been worked on for decades before the launch of Bitcoin and the underlying cryptography that really secures the protocol, of course, was, you know, under development far even before the digital cash sort of efforts began. So Peter, can you kick us off by talking about some of the major events that led up to Bitcoin's existence?
Well, you know, it's interesting where you go say, like, people have been talking about digital cash for decades, where, as I would go, the way I would go put it is, there was discussion for quite a while, but, you know, when you think about what does it actually take to get a digital currency off the ground, a big part of it is just trust, you know, trust in the cryptography. And for that, I could actually kind of say some of the most important events were really the development of the SHA-2 hashing function and, you know, the years that kind of followed that, where, all right, nothing exciting happened. You know, no one found any bugs in it. I mean, it's a funny thing, but, like, you can go look at, say, you know, early digital money schemes like Xiaomi and Cash and so on. When you actually look at what led to Bitcoin, Bitcoin's a funny thing because it sort of kind of comes out of the middle of nowhere. You know, I mean, you mentioned how I was talking to Hal Finney back in 2001. And to be perfectly honest with you, back then, we kind of didn't really have a clue what we were talking about. And I don't think anyone was actually all that close to coming up with Bitcoin. I know, I mean, I personally tried to invent Bitcoin. And that's what I tried to do in high school. And looking back at my attempts at it, they were total failures. Whereas the thing that, you know, kind of enabled Bitcoin was, yes, this totally out of the field idea with proof of work. You know, Adam Back has had a bit of a hand there, but also just like maturity, you know, just having software, you know, having hash function cryptography around for 10 years prior that hadn't been broken yet. You know, that's like such a critical thing, just to have that base.
So like most high schoolers, you were trying to invent Bitcoin, just a normal thing you do with your spare time. So who were some of the big players? Obviously, you mentioned Adam Back and Hal Finney. Who were some of the big players in the earlier days who were working on this idea of digital cash and the, you know, kind of early versions of cryptography that we have adopted into the protocol?
Oh, I'm terrible with names, but honestly, there weren't that many. I mean, especially in terms of people working on what became Bitcoin. You know, I mean, some of the kind of concepts that led to it was, for instance, talking, you know, the very first like blockchain idea seemed to come timestamping, where there was this idea that since timestamping, you know, kind of back then was this trusted thing, well, you'd want to be able to go audit the trusted notary. And one way to go audit it is just have a record of every single timestamp that they've ever created.
I think we have, there we go. He's catching back up.
Yeah.
We lost you for just a second there, but that's okay. You were talking about, you know, timestamping being sort of a fundamental component of the blockchain. And well, in fact, but Satoshi called it a timestamping.
I'd say not the timestamping per se, though. Rather, the blockchain technology and the way of auditing something that came out of attempts to basically make trusted timestamping more secure. Now, you know, and of course, as many people know, I've created a thing called Open Timestamps, which is a open standard to basically do timestamping, especially on Bitcoin. And I kind of constantly have to go push back and say, Bitcoin's not timestamping. Bitcoin is creating this auditable record, if you will, this publication. And, this kind of more nuanced ways of talking about it. But you can essentially say, like, a Bitcoin transaction, the key of it is it publishes it to a place where anyone can verify. And anyone can get the complete record of all transactions. That's what's so critical about Bitcoin. Not exactly when something happens, but rather the fact that it's in this record that we can all agree on. And that's what the timestamping chains did, but I don't think they really understood the implications of that back then. Whereas if you look at earlier digital money stuff, you get things like Chameleon Cash, which is a trusted system, and it just doesn't have these auditing concepts that Bitcoin did. Like I say, it's interesting how so many of the earlier efforts just missed the point. They just didn't quite grasp what it took to make Bitcoin. Bitcoin's this weird thing that sort of like came out of the left field, and it's actually kind of hard to link it back to sort of an earlier version of it.
Yeah. So what did you think? First of all, when did you first come across Bitcoin? Were you still on the Cypherpunk mailing list at that point? And were you, did you decide to run it? What did you first think about it when you did see the code base and the approach that Bitcoin took to implementing digital cash?
Like I, basically read the white paper, I think around late 2009 or so. Really quite early on. I honestly forget where the heck I found the white paper, but because of course I'd been looking at it before, when I read it, my response was, oh shoot, I should have thought of that. It just seems so obvious to me when I read it. It was, oh, of course that works. It just makes total sense. But at the time I was finishing off a degree and then starting another degree, plus I was working full time at a startup, and I did not pay much attention to it for a bit. But then I kind of got a bit more interested in probably maybe 2011, 2012 or so. And then finally started like looking into more of the details of code base. And, quite literally one of the things I did was I just read through the code base.
Yeah.
And I mean, even now it's really not that hard to read through. It's just not that big. And certainly back then, before some of the more complex optimizations kind of got put in, it was like a weekend project. Basically, I sat there with a, pad of paper and went through all the, went through like, well, what happens when a block comes in? What are the lines of code that do this? And I went through them one by one. And sort of the reverse of many people, I think a lot of people, they look at Bitcoin and think, well, that'll never work. Like, why would that work? Was for me, because I've kind of had the right background, was, of course this works. And then I started thinking, well, all right, what are the things that can go wrong? What breaks? And that's, for instance, when I realized, the block size would be a very big issue. And I realized a lot of the incentives around this weren't necessarily going to work properly in the way, people like, say, Mike Curran early on wanted them to.
Yeah, we're going to get into that because it's a really important part of Bitcoin's history. Guy, talk about the genesis of Bitcoin. January 3rd, 2009, the Genesis block is mined. And we see then we have the Genesis transaction a few days later. Can you talk about that period in Bitcoin's history, just the very beginning, the birth of it?
Yeah. So I certainly wasn't around way back when. I was still in middle school watching Dragon Ball Z while he was Peter was working on his own version of digital cash. But in kind of exploring that whole history, it is kind of fun to look at like just how different a lot of the proposals were, and that Peter was right, is that they really didn't have like the main idea down. Like this, I highly recommend Reason series that they just did, that documentary series on like kind of the vision of Tim May versus Salen, and how one of them was seeing kind of this front-facing thing that was going to be really efficient. And then Tim May was this uncontrollable thing. Like, we're going to build this thing that nobody can actually dictate or control. And there were a lot of different, pushes and pulls and DigiCash and all this stuff. But then, Bitcoin lands on the scene, and it kind of took the best of all worlds. Like, it created the decentralized system that had no center, and kind of as a consequence enabled a lot of these other things that were already goals or had been a main focus, like pseudonymity and these other things, just because it has to be an open system to be decentralized. Satoshi dropped a white paper on October 31st, so it was Halloween 2008, and just a couple of months later, he mines the first block, and I think that block was actually, the Genesis block was there, and the second block didn't come in for like 5 days or 6 days or something like that, so there was actually a really big gap between the release of the Genesis block and the actual kicking into gear of the system. But Hal Finney, and what I've read about Hal,
I'll actually push back on that slightly. Remember, the date on the Genesis block was, you know, January 3rd or whatever it exactly is.
Okay.
And the release of it to the public happened those couple days later. So as an example, I mean, we don't really know when the Genesis block was actually created per se. There's a date on the data, but we don't know when was that data actually created? We just don't know. For all we know, Satoshi created a script to, you know, mine it and let it run for days. You know, it's an unknowable question. But yeah, the public release was much later.
Okay. Yeah.
And the first block that was actually mined was after the public release. So for instance, we don't know if Satoshi created that block or not. Good chance the answer to that question is no, they did not.
Interesting. Okay, so technically the timestamp is just, I mean, you know, the Genesis block is the one that, you know, can't be spent from or anything anyway. It just kind of had to be generated on its own. But so I didn't realize that there was that gap between actually seeing it versus when the timestamp was.
A point to make is the Genesis block isn't real, basically. The Genesis block is kind of a figment of the code. It's block number one, which is the first actual block that, you know, gets treated normally.
Yeah, what was within the rules, and actually, because everything relates back to the previous block, and Genesis doesn't have that. Yeah. So, yeah. Awesome. Everybody knows this, but the Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks, which a lot of people think that, you know, or some people think that's just a timestamp and a way to prove when the block existed. But at the exact same time, I really think it was a political statement. You know, it was a kind of a recognition of what this thing is here for, and why. I mean, you see it right in the white paper, you know, first couple of pages, first couple of lines is, you know, all the problem with the old systems is the trust involved. And then here's the abuse of this trust in the Genesis block stamped forever. Hal Finney, in kind of digging around, it seemed like Hal Finney was, ever the optimist. And while a lot of people would read and check out Bitcoin and just be like, okay, this is kind of interesting, but, you know, everybody's been trying to make this thing work for ages and it doesn't, you know, is this really the solution, or is just this another of the many iterations of trying to piece this thing together? And Hal was on it like immediately. I'm not sure, you need to go like and retweet his post from a million years ago, running Bitcoin, but it's still there. And he was booted up his node and was mining Bitcoin. And it was on, where was the Genesis transaction? I can't remember exactly the day. It was block 170. It was like the 9th.
It was or 11th, January 11th. 11th. Yeah.
Yes. And he got the first transaction. It was sent to Hal in block 70, and it was 10 Bitcoins from block 9. And Satoshi sent it to Hal, and that was the first time. All the blocks are empty until block 170 when they sent it to Hal, Satoshi sent it to Hal. And that was kind of it, you know, like that's when it got used. Hal now owned some Bitcoins that were previously, like, that was the first UTXO exchange ever. And it worked, you know, and then from there, it was just a matter of proving it worked with three people. And then four people and, you know, continuing to build from there.
Peter, in your interactions with Hal, since you were in 16 or so when you started, when you were talking to him on the mailing list, what were your impressions of him as a person? Since you guys were discussing, you know, like math and cryptography and digital cash, I'm not sure if you got a sense of his personality, but if you did, what would you say about Hal?
You see, remember, like, you know, I was a high schooler who knew nothing about that community. I just happened to be interested in, you know, freedom and privacy and all that. And I mean, I still am kind of like this, but I've never been one to really idolize heroes or any of that. To me, it was just another voice on the mailing list. So I think it would be quite accurate. See, I kind of really did.
Yeah, you know, sure.
As far as I was concerned, it was just another guy replying to my email. So
what? Right.
You know, and I think after that, I don't think I ever had any interactions with him. But, you know, and you know, Adam Back was kind of the same thing where they actually, I'm pretty sure if I remember correctly, I didn't realize I'd been talking to Adam Back as a high schooler until well after I'd met Adam Back. And,
wow.
You know, because of course I, you know, being in the Bitcoin community for a bit of time, I kind of knew who he was and kind of knew what he was famous for. But, you know, frankly, I mean, even then in the early days, my first impression of Adam Back was, well, yeah, this guy's kind of washed up, and I mean, he invented something cool way back when with Hashcash, but he obviously doesn't understand this Bitcoin thing very well. Yeah, he's gotten better since, but my early impression of Adam Back wasn't that good.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, I've interviewed him, and he said he didn't really get into Bitcoin until 2013. So he was kind of
after me.
Later. Yeah, a later arrival. Well, speaking of, you know, people appearing and disappearing from the project, moving on, let's talk about the disappearance of Satoshi. So he was on the project for a couple of years and really leading the project, and some developers had come in, and we can talk about those developers. And there were a couple events that might have caused Satoshi's disappearance at that particular time. So Peter, do you want to kick it off and talk about that era in Bitcoin's history?
Well, you know, that one's tough because, of course, people these days have incentives to misrepresent that and present themselves as having, you know, more play in the project than they necessarily actually did. And at least the impression I get is, you know, I think, first of all, Satoshi obviously picked pseudo-anonymity for a reason. And more than just being pseudo-anonymous, I mean, a subtlety of what Satoshi did that I think a lot of people don't realize is Satoshi never actually used cryptography themselves. You know, Satoshi did not sign emails. Satoshi, as far as we can tell, literally never PGP signed a single thing. You know, we have no evidence that that PGP key on the Bitcoin.org website was ever used. Other than that one transaction, I mean, we can't say that any digital signature was ever created by Satoshi, which is interesting because it means that all of Satoshi's writings kind of stand alone because we can't actually link them to each other. So what I get out of that, knowing kind of the cypherpunk movement and that kind of ethos, is Satoshi intended very early on to leave the project. You know, if Satoshi had intended to stay, Satoshi would have used cryptography to establish a, you know, pseudo-anonymous identity, but they didn't. And I think, you know, I think that's a subtlety people forget about. So, of course, yes, there's a famous kind of, well, you know, discussion around WikiLeaks potentially accepting Bitcoin and stuff, but I don't think that, I mean, it may be kind of a trigger, but I wouldn't say it was a trigger in the sense that it changed Satoshi's plan. I think it might have gone and pushed things a little forward, but, you know, ultimately, I just do not get the impression Satoshi had any intent of staying in Bitcoin longer than necessary. I think, you know, from day zero, they had intended, I'll bootstrap this thing, get other people interested, get other people developing, and then I'm out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would go as far to say I could totally believe that Satoshi has, you know, deliberately burnt their coins, for instance, and thrown away all their private keys. You know, like if they kept that stuff, there'd be a lot of temptation to spend some of it. And there's very little evidence of that. Of course, there's also very little evidence against. You know, it's because of how Satoshi operated, it's just hard to pin down anything to them. So, you know, I think that was deliberate. Yeah. That's what I would do.
Yeah. I mean, it was, do you think Bitcoin could have worked if Satoshi had revealed who they were, their real world identity?
I mean, I think it could have, but it would provide a barrier. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so much easier when the entity identified with a project doesn't have any other attributes to them. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're the creator of something, you want that image to be just of the creator of something. You don't want anything mixed in there. You don't want any controversy. You want to be this mythical figure who disappeared.
Yeah,
that's such a great way to kind of lead things. And in terms of like legality, it probably made things a lot easier because there wasn't that, you know, I mean, no government. If Satoshi disappears, no government could say, yeah, we jailed Satoshi. Don't do this.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's the exact same thing is that I think Satoshi knew. I think this was always the plan. I think there's a couple of indications and maybe it's like, you know, the context of looking backwards and hunting for those little hints, but, you know, after it already happened. But still, I think there is plenty of indication that this was the plan from the beginning. And Gavin Andreessen having a meeting with the CIA, and then in combination with WikiLeaks, basically, like, you know, everything back in those days felt like life and death. Like, it was like, if there was good news for Bitcoin, it was so like if Bitcoin was ever in the mainstream, like it felt like, oh my God, like this is such a huge freaking deal. And then if there was ever like bad news, like a huge hack or Silk Road getting shut down, it was like, this is it. It's dead. You know, like the volatility of whether or not this thing was going to live or die was much, much higher, or at least as an observer for me, back in those days. But, you know, Gavin Andreessen meets with the CIA and WikiLeaks at the exact same or right around the exact same time. They get all of this money frozen in the banking system and they immediately, you know, are accepting Bitcoin because this is the thing, right? It's like censorship resistant. And I think there was actually a comment from Satoshi like this is a little early, like we don't want that much attention right now. Like, let's calm down or whatever. But then it was like within a couple of weeks, it was just like, it just went silent. And I think it was just Satoshi was always getting to that point, and it was looking like Bitcoin was going to survive on its own by then anyway. And it was like, this is just an opportunity for me to step away, because the more I am here and the more I'm able to be attacked, the more damaging it could be for Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin would have survived either way, but the ethos that myth of this creator that we don't know anything about and who's potentially burned their coins, the keys for all of their coins, and that kind of immaculate conception thing is incredibly powerful. And I think it makes a huge difference in the legitimacy and the independence, I guess you could say, of the Bitcoin system. There's no person to attack. No matter how much we want to put somebody at the head of it, there's really just nothing there. It's an empty seat.
Yeah, and I think that's just the ethos of Bitcoin, right? I mean, it's a decentralized system, and I think having a centralized party be sort of at the creator, have their identity known, is, you know, the antithesis of this ethos of Bitcoin. So I absolutely agree with you. And yeah, there were, Peter, go ahead.
Greg Maxwell has a kind of great line that he tells people who, you know, get interested essentially in, well, who Satoshi is. And he basically says, well, it's a bit bizarre.
We lost
you. Satoshi doesn't matter.
We lost you at it's a bit bizarre. Can you catch us up there?
yeah, so I was saying So Greg's line is, it's bizarre to put so much attention on Satoshi when their greatest creation was a system where their identity doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. That's a perfect way to put it. Maxwell has a penchant for boiling things down. He also has a penchant for writing super, super long posts. Yeah. So he does both. yeah. So the WikiLeaks event, I agree. I think that was, you know, Satoshi's intention with both of you, from the beginning. Satoshi seemed to understand that completely. The WikiLeaks events, there's a quote about that. He said that it would have been great to get the attention in either context, but WikiLeaks has kicked the hornet's nest and the swarm is headed toward us. That was when WikiLeaks was canceled. And basically any donations were not allowed by the centralized banking system. I mean, to WikiLeaks.
I've talked to Julian Assange personally about this, and Bitcoin saved WikiLeaks. It's as simple as that. I mean, mm-hmm. if Bitcoin did Absolutely. Not exist, WikiLeaks would not have existed. And yep. Bitcoin, and you know, WikiLeaks is not the only organization like this. Apparently Sci-Hub is in a similar position where, you know, not quite as fierce as WikiLeaks, but, you know, Bitcoin's one of the key things that made the difference and let them stay online, apparently.
Yeah, yeah,
there was a post from WikiLeaks a couple of years, like 3 or 4 years or something after this, is that they had like $14 million frozen through the banking system when they had this big crackdown. And they basically had to go full Bitcoin at the time. And yeah. luckily, so many of their advocates were already Bitcoiners just because, you know, the whole community and WikiLeaks and everything was married together basically from the get-go. But they made this post some years later saying, thank you for freezing our bank accounts and all of our funds, because we just wrote a 10,000%, you know, double bull market that we would have missed because because we were still relying on MasterCard and our bank account and being forced into it. We are in a much better financial position. So we really appreciate it. Thank you, totalitarian governments.
Well, Edward Snowden has said too that he paid for the servers that he transferred data to, you know, Glenn Greenwald with Bitcoin. So it's a great example of, you know, how both of those are great examples of how Bitcoin is important for freedom in this world. So then soon, a year or two after Satoshi disappeared, we had probably what was Bitcoin's first really highly publicized event. The WikiLeaks thing was the first that brought some publicity, but the Silk Road was in a whole nother level. And I was wondering if you, Guy, let's start with you on this one. What was the Silk Road exactly? Who is Ross Ulbricht? There's a lot to explore here, but let's you start where you'd like to.
Okay. So Ross Ulbricht was got into Bitcoin really early, and he was just a big freedom advocate. You could actually read a lot of his posts and stuff talking about how, you know, the ability to buy and sell voluntarily, like, simply should not be interrupted. And it doesn't really matter what they're buying and selling as long as another person's not being hurt. Like, you've got two people who want to do an exchange. And Silk Road was that experiment. It was Bitcoin is censorship resistant money. It's independent money that can't be shut down. Well, let's create a marketplace for goods that, you know, governments want to shut down, or just a marketplace that, you know, quote unquote, can't be shut down, where the buyer and seller can make an agreement. And of course, it wasn't naturally, it's not as if he was saying, oh, everybody come up here and sell drugs. But that seems to be the logical first step when you have a market like that. That's what it was. When I first heard about it, I was like, oh my God, you got to be kidding me. This is crazy. And, you know, I was kind of used to at least exploring the dark corners of the internet. So I hear about this website called the Silk Road where you can buy and sell anything. And, you know, all these articles were like, you can get meth and cocaine and all this horrible stuff. You can buy guns and all this stuff. And so I was like, I got to log into this thing. I got to see what it looks like. And it was really kind of funny because, and there was actually a MIT study some years later talking about how the dark web survives. Was it, it, it was an eBay, right? Like it looked like eBay. And I guess I was at first a little bit surprised because of all the articles I read. But then after thinking about it for like a second, it made perfect sense that it was like 90% weed. You know, like that was really the thing that everybody was buying and selling. Granted, you could get a lot of other stuff. And it survived per the MIT study, the way they really kind of dug into it and explored a lot of these dark webs. It survived on quote unquote excellent customer service. Is that because the stakes were so high in these transactions, you just didn't want to piss anybody off. Like, you know, like you want to be a good online drug vendor because your reputation was everything. If your reputation went out, nobody was going to buy from you. Like that was the cost of a bad reputation was extremely high. But you know, it lasted for a couple of years. But in the end, it was a centralized website. It was on a server on the Tor network. And they caught Ross when he had his laptop open and unlocked in a coffee shop, I think. In fact, the FBI agents staged a fight like nearby him so that he was like distracted and like looking over, and somebody from the other direction came up and scooped up his laptop, and that was that. There's all kinds of mess. I would highly suggest listening to Railroaded, the podcast about all of this stuff. It's a fascinating story, and it is a gross incompetence of our justice system, or just an injustice in general. Like, it wasn't incompetence. They did it on purpose. But everything around what happened was unbelievably, like, corrupt. All the allegations about like him murder for hire and stuff. Even the guy he was supposedly hired to murder says, no, it's bullshit. Like, this was such a sham. Like, I totally defend Ross Ulbricht in this situation.
I mean, I think that the number one thing people got to remember is that FBI agents got convicted, you know, for criminal acts related to this. You know, they were that crooked. And that incompetent too, that they got caught. You know, FBI agents usually can get away with crimes, you know, on the cases that they're involved with. But, you know, that, like, that's just the level of utter immorality we're dealing with. And, you know, it, like, all these claims, for instance, for murder for hire, I mean, they come from an FBI agent who I think he might have gotten probation in that. I have to double check. But, you know, long story short, he was convicted. I mean, I've talked to the prosecutor who was on that case. You know, like, you cannot trust any of this stuff. You know, digital evidence is trivial to go and fake. And when you're an FBI agent who is faking things to the point where you get criminal charges, you just can't trust anything. I mean, frankly, if the court system was sane, the whole case would have been thrown out the second that happened. But it's not. And that's just the way it is. You know, and in terms of what the Silk Road did, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, it was a reputation system and just made buying and selling drugs a heck of a lot safer and a lot less violent.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's shady to go buy drugs in the back of a gas station or whatever with some creepo you don't know.
And these days, of course, I mean, if I want to go and buy pot here, I go to a government website and, you know, I get it mail ordered, just like the Silk Road, but there's a different middleman in between, you know, and it will, and I'm sure by my lifetime, I will do the exact same thing for meth, cocaine, heroin, and all that other stuff. Like, that's just where society is going. You know, the Silk Road just was a little bit early.
Talk about paying for being the first one through the wall. Poor Ross, man. Oh, you're muted, man.
It's a terrible tragedy. His family is amazing. I met his mother. He has two lifetime sentences. And it's just terrible tragedy of justice. Not something that's, you know, completely surprising coming from the United States government. So he's paid a big price. And it's a very sad thing. Go to freeross.org. And you can see what you can do to help. There's petitions to sign. You can donate some money. His only hope at this point is presidential pardon. So he's got another 4 years to, you know, and that's just a very outside chance. But if we can raise some awareness, maybe it can happen. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Bitcoin's first major soft fork and then Bitcoin's first major bug. So the P2SH soft fork debate was really, I think, as far as I know, considered the first really big debate in Bitcoin. And it was a major event in terms of establishing, you know, Bitcoin's governance. So Peter, can you dive into this early debate and talk about its impact on the Bitcoin code base? Just governance.
P2SH was actually just prior to kind of when I got publicly involved in Bitcoin. Though it was after I started basically, you know, reading Bitcoin Talk. And I think what's interesting about it is the P2SH debates did seem to be about tech. And, you know, while there was debate, it was sort of on the debate of different competing technical ideas. And, you know, there's like Luke Jr. with his proposal, like Gavin Andresen kind of had another proposal. You know, there's like Greg Maxwell kind of talking pros and cons of different stuff. And, you know, I think long story short is people, I get the sense, felt that it ended up being a bit rushed. And I think was also kind of showing some of the initial influence of sort of personality in politics, where, you know, Gavin Andresen really wants to go push this thing quite early. And I think you make a good argument that it kind of, it got pushed earlier than it really needed to. You know, had people thought through things a bit more, you could have, you know, come to kind of better conclusion about it and so on. But, you know, ignoring that part, what's also interesting about it is that it was done as a soft fork, intentionally. You know, and by soft fork, I mean, it was done in a way where miners tighten the rules so that blocks that were previously invalid, or sorry, previously valid are now invalid. And, you know, concretely, I mean, P2SH to a version, you know, 0.1 Bitcoin node looks like an output that anyone can go spend. So P2SH added a rule saying, well, unless you go jump through these hoops, you're not allowed to go spend it. And that wasn't the first soft fork, but it was sort of the first soft fork done as a new feature. And I think like that's a really key step in kind of Bitcoin's evolution, figuring out, yes, we can upgrade the system. You know, whereas if you look at Bitcoin at the very first release, frankly, like I don't think Satoshi had really thought through how upgrades would work. For instance, he had this op code, which literally pushed the version of the software you're running to the stack. And had anyone used that, the whole network would have just exploded. You know, not necessarily a great idea. Kind of looks like something, you know, maybe made by an academic who is going to be teaching a class in January and kind of pushing out the door. But, you know, that got disabled and fixed. But, you know, P2SH kind of set a precedent there. However, it didn't really set a precedent for figuring out, I think, the bigger political ramifications, which, of course, comes later with the block size wars, which I'm sure we'll get into later.
Yes, we absolutely will. Guy, just before we move on, you want to give us a quick, just tell us what P2SH is and what it means for the audience. And, you know, I think Peter did a good job of talking about what a soft fork is. So, but just, yeah, I realized that we didn't really start off by explaining what P2SH is or even what it stands for as an acronym.
Okay. As I understand it, it's pay to script hash. Prior to this, if Todd, correct me if I'm a little bit off on this, but prior to this, basically the main format was pay to public key. It basically meant that like when someone would send a transaction, you would write all the stipulations about how that transaction was going to be spent. And essentially the person who would send it to you would be the one who would have to pay the fee for all of that extra data. Whereas P2SH made it so that you paid to a hash of that. And then the person who wanted all of those stipulations would then have to reveal it after they spent from that address. So
actually a really more fundamental reason why that change was made, which is, first of all, why might you want more stipulations? Well, multisig. You know, you might want to have, say, two or three computers sign off on a transaction. Well, multisig, the actual script, of course, is longer because there's more than one key. And if there's a whole bunch of keys, you can't put in a QR code. You know, that's your explanation right there. You know, you needed a way of having a short address format that could stick in a QR code, and P2SH let you keep it short. Simple as that.
So the operation or the switching of the fee obligation was just kind of a consequence of the fact that we needed a compact way to write transactions. Okay, interesting.
I mean, you're totally right that that's a concern, but you know, I think what Gavin was concerned about was multisig and how do you shove that into an address format and be able to put in a QR code. Simple as that.
There you go. So the first soft fork to add some functionality or major feature to Bitcoin. And that sort of, like Peter said, that interaction, that debate about, you know, technically which route to go, which solution to implement, sort of presaged the block size debate, but that was the block size debate was a much, much more heated, we can say.
I'd say the key thing with P2SH is that all the alternatives, the differences were technical in that, you know, one might work a little better in one way, one might work a little better in a different way. You know, one might make it harder to do something else in the future, but they were all kind of things which really weren't that relevant from a user's point of view, you know, from like a stakeholder's point of view. Certainly they'd have an impact, you know, if you went the wrong way, but it wasn't like P2SH wasn't potentially changing what Bitcoin was. Right. P2SH just made Bitcoin a bit better.
So, okay. So let's roll into the block size debate then. We'll come back to maybe to Mt. Gox, but it, you know, on the timeline, the block size debate was after Mt. Gox, but I think it flows well from the conversation we're having right now. So there's the block size debate. First of all, Peter, I'll just let you define what the block size debate, the scaling wars, is. It's also called the resolution of this battle for, you know, the soul of Bitcoin, really. In 2017, I think was a major inflection point for the project. It started well before the resolution and went on for quite some time. So can you just kind of lay the foundation for us for this discussion?
Well, I mean, the block size debate was, I think, really what got me actively into Bitcoin. You know, if you kind of trace back, I mean, why people even know what my name is, it's ultimately debating Gavin on the block size debate. And you know, you then ask, well, why would this be so important? It's because the block size really says, how do we use Bitcoin and who gets to control it? And the reason why this matters is if you want to just send some money around, I mean, you could just do this with Coinbase. You know, you get an account, you have some Bitcoin held by someone else, they're doing all the work for you, they're, you know, you're trusting them. And if I have a Coinbase account and want to send money to you, well, I just tell Coinbase to do it on my behalf. And certainly that works for some people, but it's not that different from the existing banking system. Whereas at the other end, you know, I mean, on my home computer sitting like 10 feet away from me, I've run a Bitcoin full node. And it has a copy of all the necessary data to completely verify Bitcoin transactions to the same level of security as anyone else. And I am complete control of what is the definition of Bitcoin that I consider Bitcoin. But it's really bound. I mean, if someone wants to change what Bitcoin is, people like me, ones who have to decide to accept that change. And I mean, I've personally proposed a change to the Bitcoin protocol. And I've both been one of the people proposing it and also, like many, many other people, being in the position of verifying that. So, okay, let's sit back. How do I run this node? Well, because I have a computer that can process, you know, 4 megabytes of data every 10 minutes, which doesn't necessarily sound like much, but it adds up. And I can easily do this because, well, a modern computer, that's easy to do. Now, what's the limitation of that? Well, the limitation is that all your transactions have to fit into 4 megabytes every 10 minutes. And that's much more limited than, say, Visa. You know, Visa can do literally tens of thousands of transactions per second. And back in, you know, back in 2013, 2014, I think there are a lot of people who are just dead set on, well, obviously, we're just going to push Bitcoin in this direction where people are trusting others to do the verification for them. And then we'll just have some dedicated professionals running Bitcoin nodes, which is, you know, how Ethereum works right now. So the block size debate is really a question of, well, what is Bitcoin? You know, how are we going to use Bitcoin in the future? Who gets to control it? You know, that's why it's such a fundamental debate. And there's technical aspects to it. You know, for instance, my first kind of big public contribution to that was kind of a technical argument as to what are the incentives for how big a block a miner should make, and do they make more money by making a bigger block or smaller block, and what kind of miners make more money? And I was able to go show with a very simple, clean argument that if there is no limit on block size, like Gavin Andresen wanted, then big miners would have an incentive to make bigger blocks to push their competition out of business. And the reason why that works is, well, if you're a miner, I can't make, you know, if I'm a miner, I can't make money unless I have the most recent block. You know, until I have the most recent block, I'm not earning money. Well, the way the math works out and the incentives works out is, if I have more hashing power than a certain threshold, it is in my incentive for blocks to be bigger, because the competition getting hurt by this is more of an advantage to me than the harm it does to myself in getting my blocks propagated faster. You know, that's a really fundamental force in what will mining look in the future. And, you know, my role there was, Chris, to argue, well, this is a bad thing. We need to go put a hard limit on this and therefore preserve the ability of anyone to participate in Bitcoin fully.
Yeah, I would say probably Todd, Luke, and Maxwell were probably the key things that made me wrap my head. Because at the time, you know, I was just kind of a really excited observer. You know, I was just, everything was just interesting to me. I was just like, all right, how do we, you know, how does this thing move forward? And during that whole span, I was basically reading everything I could get my hands on. Well, not unlike I do now. I was just trying to consume all of it and make sense of any of it, because I still didn't have a really great idea. I haven't really dug into how it worked. You know, there were plenty of big gaps at that time. But it was a question of what Bitcoin was going to be. Like, how was this thing going to work? I find it interesting too that the constant debate seem to be like, we seem to be like the quote unquote two sides, the people who wanted to raise the block size and the people who wanted to keep it small, seemed to be having two completely different conversations. They weren't arguing from the same framework. Like the small blockers, quote unquote, were arguing from a point of how do we change Bitcoin and who defines what Bitcoin is. And the big blockers were arguing from the standpoint of, do we want high fees or low fees? It really wasn't even the same conversation. And in fact, you can see in the quote unquote compromise of SegWit2x exactly how divorced the framing both sides were. Is they said, okay, well, we'll do a hard fork and we'll give you your soft fork SegWit, and then that'll be a compromise. It's like, no, that's a completely a rejection of the other argument. Like, you're not even recognizing that there's a different thing at risk here. You're staking what Bitcoin is. Do we get to validate or not? It's funny, one of the things that I learned during that whole period, and there were so many great, like, concise arguments. I loved Maxwell's multi-stage rocket argument. That was one analogy that really made it click after I was like deep into it for a couple of months. But I found it really funny that the very first response to the Bitcoin white paper on the mailing list was essentially, I don't know it like word by word, but it was essentially, this is a really interesting system, but it will never scale. Like, it can't like encompass transactions without basically a massive trade-off. That took 6 years to come to fruition, you know, 6-7 years to really start to play out and for us to legit put it on the table and argue, what is Bitcoin's future here? But the way I always analogize it, to try to make sense of how, like, I wrote a article after 2 years, 3 years of digging through this and finally feeling like I came down really hard on the, yeah, we're not raising the block size, I wrote an article, seven misunderstandings of the Bitcoin block size debate. An analogy that I really like to use since is that, you know, Todd was talking about, that Visa handles tens of thousands. In fact, like during peaks and stuff, during like holiday season, it's like 60,000, 70,000 transactions per second. And the number of times we've seen this go bad, I mean, it was like just BSV, not like a couple of months ago, after saying, oh, we can do millions of transactions per second, there's no limit. They had like a 15 megabyte block, which is like pathetically small on the scale of this thing, that took like 12 minutes just to verify, like, yeah, that one block. And it was like, that's longer than the block time. Like, you can't, you're just, all you can do is accept that block, and you don't know if anything invalid is in it. Like, the whole thing's up in smoke. Like, at that point, 15 megabytes, you've just dumped the whole thing down the toilet.
I think that the key thing I want to say about the block size debate is it was never a debate on technical merits, ever. You know, and I think you're so right to point out how literally the first, you know, email in response to Satoshi's announcement was, this is going to scale. You know, anybody who understood a shred of things about technology would understand the technical trade-off of this, and that it's fundamentally unsolvable if you want a decentralized system. Like, it's, you know, and it's funny thinking back to how, like, prior to me, like, doing Bitcoin full-time, I was working, well, first of all, my background's a bit funny. I mean, I have a fine arts degree, and then I somehow wound up doing analog electronics design, and I also did part of a physics degree. So I kind of have quite a varied background there. But the reason why I got into Bitcoin was because I looked at this block size debate and realized, this is going to be political. And I like politics. And this sounds interesting because I get to go and, you know, mix multiple things I'm good at, you know, frankly, including like public speaking and, you know, evangelizing and all this stuff. And that was what attracted me. So it's funny you then go say, well, all right, myself, like Gregory Maxwell, Luke Jr. and so on, were involved in this. Well, the reason of that was because we were the only people who I think had the most patience for dealing with politics. Like I say, there was never any technical debate on people who weren't scammers. You know, I'm sorry, but like Gavin has proven to be a scammer. You know, Mike Curran, he's actually not so much a scammer anymore, because I think he went off to like corporate world. But, you know, like that was the route he was going. I mean, Jeff Garzik, who the heck is that guy, right? Well, because he got caught up in scams. Like, there's just nobody who was on that side who was technically inclined and wasn't dishonest or a straight up scammer. Like, it's just such a one-sided thing. And that's why the block size debate wasn't resolved with technical arguments. It was resolved with political maneuvering. You know, it was resolved with like building communities. I mean, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but like a bunch of hats actually helped move the block size debate forward, because it turned this issue into something where I think the non-technical people started to latch on to and realize like what was really at stake there. And the key technical thing that I think resolved it was actually the Lightning Network, you know, because it created this alternative that would actually work.
Yeah, because since harder. There was, oh, sorry, you got cut off there for a second. I thought you had stopped.
There, we're back.
Sorry, go ahead, guy.
Oh, I was agreeing.
Obviously,
with
the government doesn't want me to talk about Lightning. Yeah. Government doesn't want me talking about Lightning.
Yeah, it's a privacy. It's a too private.
Too private. Unfairly private.
Unfairly private.
The Lightning Network really was like to finally have a model, particularly, which was funny, was that it was Satoshi's model. Like it was Satoshi's original concept of payment channels. It was just a completely different manifestation of them into a network rather than isolated channels. But it was a way to visualize how we could get multiple layers on top of this thing that maintained decentralization. Decentralization in a different way and with different trade-offs and like a new security dynamics. Like, it's a very different system. I talk about it a lot. Is that when I finally, like, wrapping my head around Lightning the first time felt very similar to wrapping my head around Bitcoin. Like, it is its own unique beast. It's just Bitcoin derived. It's derived from that model. But it's absolutely fascinating. I think that really did make a key difference in making it seem like we weren't just giving up the fact that we want to be able to scale this thing to 60,000, 100,000, million transactions per second. But how do we get there without just saying, no, it'll be figured out. You know, there will be engineering challenges, but we'll get there. That we can actually point to something is that, like, this model, like, we already have something that very well could work, and it seems to be working. It's worked great for me. In the context of the block size debate, is that they would argue that this was about low fees. And, like, if you really took a step back and looked at this thing, you realize that there is no block size increase that can get us there. There's no way to not have full blocks, whether it's 100 megabyte blocks, whether it's a gigabyte block. It really just doesn't matter, because the scope of the problem is so massive. This isn't about matching Visa. Like, if we had to run all transactions through Visa, everything Visa would break. Visa couldn't handle it. Visa is one piece of a massive global network of payment systems, of tiered networks, of banks and settlements and all sorts of crap. We're talking about an internet native system that should be able to scale indefinitely. And the analogy I like to use is that, like, you know, somebody's like, oh, 8 megabyte blocks, our fees are cheaper and we're so much better than Bitcoin. Is that it's like having two people standing in front of the ocean. Like, they're literally like on the beach standing in the ocean. One person has a cup and the other person has a bucket, and the person with the bucket is, and it's an argument about who can hold more of the ocean. And the person with the bucket is like, see, mine's better than yours. But in comparison to the problem, you might as well just throw them both away. Like, neither one of them has any relative, the ocean has no idea that we put it in a bucket or a cup. Like, they're absolutely irrelevant at the scale of what the actual problem is. And just going to 8 megabytes, 10 megabytes, 20 megabyte blocks is such a huge compromise to not even come close to tackling the problem. You've already had to hard fork. You've already had to break the fundamental consensus of the network and the community. You've already put at risk the entire validation of the system, that all the rules are just, yeah, sure, it's just 8 terabytes for the blockchain. Don't worry about it. We don't need nodes. We don't need anybody validating the miners. We'll just trust them. Like, you've gone to a highly centralized system just in minor block size increases, and you've done nothing. You've done nothing to solve the problem. There's no way to not do this with layers. And I think when that finally clicked, that the argument we were having was hilariously, what's the word? Just so insignificant in comparison to the issue at hand of actually scaling this thing to a global transaction system where we can do all sorts of payments and have all sorts of networks and layers on top of it. The block size debate is just so irrelevant. It's so irrelevant. The only concern is whether or not we can validate and whether or not this thing is decentralized. And there's a clear, absolute answer as to which one does that.
Yep. Yeah. Before we move on, Peter, can you tell us just a little bit more detail about the proposed solutions? I know one of them actually, like, just shat the bed, basically. and talk about UASF, and this is what was on the hats that you mentioned, the user activated soft fork, and yeah, how that, you know, this is really what kind of defined Bitcoin's governance model for everyone.
Yeah, well, so pre-SegWit, there were two different proposals to effectively get rid of the block size increase, remove the block size, you know, modify the block size increase, I mean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there really are a lot of them. And I think that the key thing SegWit did provided a way to kind of put a, you know, kind of provide this sort of pseudo compromise where we say, yeah, we're technically doing a block size increase because SegWit actually does increase the block size, but it does it in a way where it's impossible to repeat. You know, the wit, like basically because SegWit takes signature data and puts it in the separate soft forked in area, you can't do it twice because you can only move that signature data to a new part once. You know, like there's just no more data to go around to do it again. So politically, that was very good. And also by that point, when SegWit was proposed, people had already kind of the basics of what Lightning would be. And they realized it really needed SegWit to function. You know, the exact technical word, I think, are maybe a bit beyond what I can put 5 minutes. But what was interesting was kind of as SegWit was being talked about, you then also got academics kind of coming and saying, no, you know, we should do it this other way and so on. I mean, one of the very funniest examples being, you know, Emin Sirer, who wanted us to all use trusted compute to our equivalent of Lightning channels. You know, and he was very against like SegWit for that reason. And it just made no sense, you know. And again, I think it's a great example of kind of scams you're up against. So kind of then going forward a bit, well, then you get this weird bit of like minor negotiation where people kind of, you know, and I was part of this. I mean, we flew off to Hong Kong to go talk to miners, mostly in China, and, you know, about like what Bitcoin could be and what kind of compromises there were. And, you know, I think most of what happened there was kind of bought time to push things a little forward, you know, get SegWit in a better place technically. And then kind of SegWit then gets created. Well, of course, miners aren't really looking like they actually want to implement this. And I don't really, it doesn't really surprise me. I mean, if you're a big miner, SegWit, because of where it would put Bitcoin, was going to take away your power. You know, it was obviously going to end up allowing Lightning to happen, removing the need for more block size increases and removing that leverage you have over your competitors. So where the new ASF comes from is it says, well, all right, the previous way that SegWit was going to be implemented was by having miners signal their readiness for it. And once a certain percentage of miners is signaled, the rules of the consensus system would say, all right, SegWit's now active. So the UASF guy said, all right, well, why don't we do a user-acted soft fork where all these users will run software that if SegWit isn't active by a certain date, we'll just say it's active and reject blocks that aren't SegWit compatible, you know. And that's from a political point of view, you can argue it one way or the other, but from a purely technical point of view, as in will or will not the system fork and fall down, you certainly can make the case that it was an incredibly dangerous thing to do. It was sort of like holding the gun to the head of everyone saying, if you don't activate SegWit, you know, who the hell knows what's going to happen. And what's interesting about the UASF movement is, I think quite correctly, a lot of sort of developer types were unwilling to kind of put their neck out saying, this is what we should do. It's just a very small minority of people, like, you know, the pseudonym BC Drake, who was kind of pushing this, but it got support in the community. You know, it got the hats, for instance. I mean, I've got a UASF hat somewhere around in my apartment. And it got enough support. Because of course SegWit was a very big improvement, it was obviously a way to go, that I think miners finally capitulated and said, well, you know, if we don't enable this, who knows what's going to happen? And nobody really wanted that question to be answered. So sure enough, suddenly miners are all supporting SegWit and then enables with old rules. You know, would UASF have worked or not? I have no idea. I really don't. But what I do know was enough of a gun to the head of everyone that they agreed to do the same thing and let SegWit activate by signaling support for it. And that was, you know, very undramatic. Meanwhile, Jeff Garzik's SegWit 2X thing, or whatever the heck he called it, you know, it was some shoddy code that literally like fell apart on the day it activated. And it was supposed to be this forked blockchain. And, you know, we also got Bcash, which was like its own thing. It turned into BSV when it forks again. I mean, I'm kind of hesitant to say too much about the details of some of these, because frankly, I don't pay enough attention to exactly what Big 2X is doing. But I think what I'd say, though, but I think what I want to go say, though, in summary is, when you look at the details of them, they usually look like people trying to go make money by creating their own coin. You know, Bcash was a money-making opportunity. Simple as that.
Yeah, these were Bcash and BSV were forks, hard forks of Bitcoin. So they became separate networks from Bitcoin that increased the block size. And, you know, the market has clearly chosen Bitcoin as the actual Bitcoin. So, you know, this it really just proved, I think, in my mind, the way I always put it when people ask me questions about UASF is that it really proved that miners want to mine the chain users want to use. And so if users are really in control of the network, and that's what it proved. If you don't have users, I wouldn't say it was proof.
I would say it was proof that the threat of that is enough. But remember, it never really came to push to shove because miners capitulated. You know, and I would not want to go say that UAS would necessarily worked. On the other hand, I think it is very, very clear that it might have.
Yeah.
And that should terrify any miner who thinks they're going against user opinion.
Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a really interesting dynamic too, is like, because SegWit screwed up covert ASIC boost, Bitmain at the time had in their miners. And this all kind of,
Can you explain what that means, Guy? Like,
I was about to get there. So there was basically a way to get a 10 or 15% bonus in miner efficiency, and do so in a way I can't exactly remember anymore what it is about the covert ASIC boost that made it so that you couldn't tell why that somebody was using it. But there was basically an overt version and a covert version, a hidden one, and then a very visible version of it. And I think it was Maxwell actually that realized that like reverse engineered or like tore apart a miner found out that covert ASIC boost was in these Bitmain miners. The SegWit upgrade actually would turn that off. So essentially they couldn't do it unless they did it publicly. For a while, a whole bunch of like,
and keep in mind, ASIC boost was patented.
Yes, that's so right. It was all patented.
Yeah,
I forgot. Yeah. That's what this was all about.
And remember, at this point, Bitmain was like by far the dominant mining computing producer. So they had massive influence over the system at this point because they were producing 70% or something like that of all mining computers.
ASIC boost had already become a big issue at that point, but, and I may be getting my history wrong, if I remember correctly, Bitmain was denying that they were doing it when in reality they probably were.
The
covert method. Yeah.
Basically a bunch of people defended them. A bunch of big blockers were saying, no, this isn't even in there. I remember having a conversation with somebody who's like, how the hell would Maxwell have found out? That's stupid and ridiculous. Like, he's doing all this code and being on Reddit, and then, you know, he's figuring it out. And what was hilarious is it was a couple of weeks later that Bitmain admitted. They said, okay, yeah, we have covert ASIC boost, but we're not using it. So they built this thing into their machines, but we can use it in a hidden fashion in which nobody would ever be able to prove it, but we're not doing it. Yeah, like that was literally their statement. I kept responding and posting back that. It's like, yeah, sure, you're right. Bitmain's not using it.
And on top of this, you get like bizarreness with this, you know, backdoor-ish looking bug they had into their firmware. And like, it just goes on and on. I mean,
it just looked worse and worse for them. Yeah. And I think that's where it really turned against them politically. So SegWit2x was, after it finally became obvious that there was no technical issue with SegWit, and the big push against it was an ASIC boost, was about having a profit margin that they could monopolize.
To be clear, the push from that mining community, there was definite push from, for instance, companies that wanted to continue doing transaction analysis, because Lightning destroys that ability. You know, it's Lightning isn't perfect privacy, but it is so much better than Bitcoin. And of course, sure enough, we find out, for instance, like Jeff Garzik had a financial interest in a company doing chain analysis, and he was one of the people like against Liquid. I mean, it's just an endless story of very bad incentives.
Yeah. And it was kind of beautiful to see, like after essentially there was capitulation of SegWit, but it was, I like to refer to it as earmarked, is they said, okay, we will give you SegWit. This was the New York agreement, is we'll give you SegWit, but you're going to take our hard fork attached to the back of it, is that we're also going to break consensus. And that's our compromise, is that you get nothing of what you want. You don't get the protection and the verification of Bitcoin. We're going to break the consensus rules, but we'll give you your SegWit. And they had like 90% of the miners sign up and sign on this, or the hash power sign on this agreement. So many of the major companies, Coinbase, the list was pretty shocking. And I remember those conversations about, like, this was basically what was like user activated soft fork. It was like, we're just not playing this, we're going to call their bluff. They're saying, they literally said, we're going to fire all the developers. We are going to fork the chain. We are going to attack the legacy chain, and you're not going to be able to use it. You're not going to be able to, you can't mine it, because all the mining power is going to go to this new one. It's going to be a dead chain, and you're going to come to our network or not. And the user activated soft fork said, come at me, bro. All right, we'll call your bluff. We'll let you fork off. We will give you exactly what you want, and we're going to run this client that doesn't listen to you, that doesn't join your network, and we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. And the game theory played out. They capitulated, and thank God, because like he said, Garzik, I can't tell you how many times I argue with people, and they were like, the block size debate is just moving one line. You're just changing one line. It's the easiest, safest thing ever. And they didn't do it right. They broke it with that one freaking change. I was just like, Jesus, thank God we saved it from these idiots.
Well, I'll tell you, I think Bitcoin actually got incredibly lucky that Ethereum existed, because Ethereum attracts all the sort of dishonest but actually kind of competent developers. To get Ethereum working at all requires a lot of competence. Ethereum is so fundamentally broken technologically that the fact that it can work at all is actually kind of a miracle. It does have a whole lot of very bright developers on it who just don't really care about the stuff we care about. And because of that, and because he had all this ICO stuff and so on and so forth, I think the likes of Jeff Garzik had actually a real hard time getting competent developers to just do that one line of code competently. like, who wants to work for Jeff Garzik? Well, I don't. If I'm going to do that, why don't I go work in the Ethereum crowd where, we're beginning to get this ICO thing where I could make tons of money.
I just make a token that you can print if you stake this other token, and then you can sell that token for my new token. It just would be great. Yeah.
And Garzik,
it's far more interesting.
Yeah. And Garzik did that too. I don't think it was on Ethereum, but he had some Bitcoin, I don't know.
Other tokens. What was his coin?
I think he's done more than one, but
yeah
it's like what's the metronome.
Yep, that was it. That was coins.
Yeah.
And these things were just, like all of the altcoins still today, just all marketing hype and no substance. And Bitcoin's really the only one that matters on the global stage at this point, and the only one that will continue to matter. And it's
I will push back a little, say like Zcash in Monero.
In terms of, they
have interesting technology in some ways, but they just have this fundamental problem that Bitcoin's good enough.
Right.
And Bitcoin plus Lightning really gets rid of a lot of the advantages. Bitcoin plus Lightning plus Liquid, I don't need my coins to be, I don't need my long-term savings to be private if I can get into them in a private way. And unfortunately for something like Zcash, because it exists, if I want private Bitcoin, I can always get the same guarantees as Zcash by selling my Bitcoin, buying Zcash, doing the opposite again. It's such a hard thing for them to compete with. And Bitcoin is just fundamentally safer to keep value in because it's so simple.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like, and it's got the network effect, you know, going forward at this point, like Zcash and Monero trying to compete with network effect would be.
I'll say clearly. So the comparison there is, say, Bitcoin and Litecoin. You know, they're technologically similar enough that the network effect thing is a good argument. Right. I don't think Zcash could win against Bitcoin, even with network effect, because Zcash is fundamentally more dangerous. You know, they've had bugs that would destroy the entire currency.
Yep.
Bitcoin has had bugs that require ugly forks and so on, but they've never destroyed, you know, had the potential to destroy the currency, because every Bitcoin, you know, because every Bitcoin, we know where it is, you can fix things that go wrong.
Right.
You know, if Zcash is an inflation bug, that's it.
Yeah, that's the
currency's done for.
That's the fundamental problem, is that, like, if you don't have complete auditability in the supply, then you're entirely reliant on whatever your cryptographic assumption is about verifying the supply. And if that breaks and you can't see it, there's no fixing it. There's no, like, rollback to get rid of that $1 billion or that 1 billion new Zcash transaction, because you don't know where it is. You don't, like, it's you've traded off the monetary security for a potential feature that you can probably get in another way. In fact, we know you can get in another way without compromising the money. And at the end of the day,
I mean, you can get it by buying Zcash and then selling it for Bitcoin. that's a problem they face. And, you know, I think the comparison, like, it's not to say something like Zcash could never happen, but the thing is, Bitcoin and Zcash both rely on math. The difference is, Zcash relies on math that maybe 100 people in the entire world understand. Fair. Bitcoin relies on math that a 6-year-old understands.
So, isn't there a comparison here too? There was an inflation bug briefly on Bitcoin quite a long time ago. Isn't that correct?
Yes. And so I think that's a great example, because, you know, let's look. Well, what happened with that inflation bug? Well, very literally, we implemented 1 + 1 = 2 incorrectly. You know, and that's not even a joke, really. It's that. Yeah. The way the numbers were added together allowed them to overflow. And when they overflow, they wrap around to a much bigger number due to the intricacies of how computers work. And because they wrap around a much bigger number, we'll suddenly have a huge pile of Bitcoin. You know, the programmer will probably go and be complaining at how wrong I am there. But that's basically what happened. But because all of this was visible, well, we know exactly what overflowed. We know exactly what coins were affected. It got noticed really quickly. You know, probably some guy with a script just adding up, well, how many Bitcoins in existence are they are? The script pointed out a number that made no sense. And the guy immediately said, oh, shoot, well, that's not right. And, you know, someone immediately posted on, like, I think it was probably like IRC was the first time it got mentioned, or, you know, Bitcoin Talk. And long story short, within, you know, a couple hours of it happening, people knew it had happened. And very soon after that, people come up with a fix. And the fix is really obvious. The fix is, well, you make the rules sane and you tell your client, please go apply these rules. In fact, back then, I think probably been, please apply these rules from the very start of the chain, and then just throw away the blocks that, you know, didn't make sense. People apply that fix, they reset their nodes, and that's that. A few hours later, it's done.
Yep.
You know, a couple, I think probably, you know, 20, 30 blocks, something got thrown away because they were invalid by the rules that we thought we had all along. But, you know, this is a very easy fix. And it's the type of thing people could do under stress and get right. You know, it's the type of thing that anyone can check to make sure it's right. Like, there's just so many things going for it. And also, I'll point out, there's a subtle block size implication here too, which is, because the block size was small, the fix technologically could be very simple. Because you just had to restart your node, you know, and wait an hour for all the blocks to get resynced. Right. It'd be a little harder now because, you know, frankly, like, nodes have a lot more data to resync. But compare that to something like, say, Ethereum, where the block size is so big and there's so much data that it's really hard to get a full copy of it. You know, if something goes wrong on Ethereum, you may not have access to the data to fix it, especially if you don't notice for a while, which is more likely to happen if the block size is big enough that very few people are monitoring the entire chain. You know, these things kind of impact on one another. By the time you get to Zcash and sort of the hypothetical Visa transaction scale, you probably would never notice until months later. You had no idea how many coins are being inflated, and you'd have no good solutions to fixing it. Like, I'm sorry, but you know, this makes these things very dangerous. You need these systems to be simple at the layer that protects the integrity of the currency.
Yeah, that was always something that was super critical in my understanding of the block size debate as well, was that it's not about, like, people would argue, it's like, oh, there's plenty of bandwidth for 20 megabyte blocks, and you know, we can validate them with this much CPU power and all this stuff, and it's really easy to keep up with it. And it's like, well, no, the protection of the long-term sustainability, like the ability for this thing to survive, is in the case of the worst scenario, is when shit goes wrong. Like, what happens when you lose half the nodes on the network because of some bug, which inevitably, like, you have to assume might happen, or just some nuclear scenario, some horrible incident that just hits a whole operating system and knocks off half the nodes on the network. Do we get those nodes back? Can they go back to the Genesis block and catch up? Or are we at the absolute max where all we can do is stay synced with the nodes that we have? Well, then we just lose half the nodes. If the latter is where we are sitting, we lose half the nodes and they never come back. And then the next time 10 nodes go offline, they go offline permanently. And then we lose five more. And then 100 people cut it off because it's just the computer's running too hot and it's a waste of time. You know, like, and it just forever gets more and more centralized. Or we have a network that we can resync, that we can get back from zero if something really bad happens.
I always thought it was funny around the block size debate, talking to people who actually worked in banking, you know, like that kind of financial infrastructure. And like, he'd explain to them what the debate was about. They'd say, yeah, that's crazy. Why on earth would you want these incredible challenges? Like, we can barely keep up with the stuff in centralized systems with, you know, top-down control and backups and procedures. You know, it's really, really hard to run systems close to limits, even if you have the budget of a major bank, you know, charging people through the nose for every transaction. It is hard to think you could do that in a decentralized system or even a semi-centralized system. It's crazy talk. But, you know, that's the difference between a competent engineer at a bank who understands comp sci and doesn't have an agenda, and a guy who wants to sell you on fairy tales because he'll make a short-term dollar.
You can tell just how important this event was in the history of Bitcoin, because we've been talking about it for probably 40 minutes now. And I would say it's the most important event in Bitcoin's history. And since then, that was, you know, it was resolved in mid to late 2017. Since then, we've seen Bitcoin, the trust in Bitcoin, really take off. And now Bitcoin is being bought up by major corporations. It's being hedge funds and insurance companies. People really trust it as a store of value now. And I think that was one of the results that came out of the UASF. And it was like, okay, well, this is what Bitcoin is. This is how it's governed. And now we can trust it as real money, as a real store of value. So over the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of infrastructure get developed, including the protocols, like Lightning Network and Layer 3 protocols that are coming out now, like RGB. And we've seen companies, the Bitcoin only industry, actually starting to emerge now, like Swan. We're seeing a massive increase in the amount of educational material about Bitcoin itself, like directly about Bitcoin specifically, books, essays, podcasts. And there's so many out there now that people who are coming in 2019, 2020 are really able to just come up to speed much more quickly than they were before. And so it really feels like, as an outcome at that inflection point in 2017, that Bitcoin's just really taken off since then. Do you guys want to comment on just like the past few years, some highlights for you and the, you know, events that you think were particularly important?
It's funny, it's hard to put, say, in a particular event, but definitely seeing Lightning kind of progress, I think really was, you know, sort of a great demonstration of what's possible to actually build. Although I don't think Lightning is necessarily the reason why, you know, major corporations, for instance, are putting Bitcoin on their balance sheets. I think that's actually kind of a separate thing. And I think that, you know, like you say, kind of comes out of just stability. You know, the world realized Bitcoin is a serious thing run by serious people with a culture that's there to stay. And the more that, you know, I mean, that's one of those things that just snowballs. You know, it is network effect, and it is just showing that this thing can survive and showing that it's simple enough to survive. You know, I personally, kind of after the block size debate, you know, really like after like SegWit, I kind of stopped contributing directly to Bitcoin Core. You know, I haven't read sort of the technical proposals put forth and so on. I mean, frankly, I could explain to you how Taproot works, but not very well. But that's okay. It's okay to have a system that kind of stagnates at the bottom layer, because you can always put stuff on top. And I've been focused on building things on top of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Guy, you want to give a quick comment on this topic as well, and then we'll wrap things up. This has been fantastic, and I really appreciate you guys' time and expertise and sharing this. I think it'll be a great episode to share with people who are coming into the space now. And I know for a fact that we have quite a few people who have bought their first Bitcoin on Swan listening to this episode and learning a lot about Bitcoin and its history. And like I said, coming up to speed very quickly. Go ahead, Guy.
Absolutely. So in the context of the last couple of years, it really has just been Lightning. I agree with Peter that institutional investors and like seeing Bitcoin as like a secure place to keep money outside of the traditional system, as a hedge against the system itself, like the systemic risks of infrastructure, but then also just of a secure monetary policy that can't be just endlessly debased. I think Bitcoin would have seen this sort of run regardless. Like, I don't think Lightning is like making massive adoption moves and everybody wanting to buy Bitcoin because, oh, Lightning is there. But personally, from going from, booting up my first Lightning node on CLI back in, 2018 early, and then to where it is now, like, it's so fascinating to think about. The gap is just, they don't look anything like each other. It just, like, I use it constantly, like all the time. And then Strike coming on the scene recently, like, it's stupid easy. Like, I have like 5 Lightning wallets and I use them interchangeably. And without question, it's 100x increase in the amount of payments that I can make versus on chain. Like I only need about one out of every 100 times I need to do something. I do something on chain. I have to loop out because I filled up my wallet, or I have to, just that alone, like, we've got 100x block size increase with technology that's available today, whether or not it's being widely used. It exists as a functional technology, that is 100x quote unquote block size increase with no loss to verification, no loss to decentralization. That's an unbelievably powerful thing that we've made it that far in like 2.5 years. And that arguing about it for 2 years prior to that, saying, no, it's possible, it's going to work. Like it can be built out. It's just a huge engineering challenge. And then to see it actually come to fruition. And I think we're at the cusp of Lightning really coming into its own. I think Strike is going to be one of those first things that proves just how powerful it can be and in what context. And then to see institutions suddenly see Bitcoin as a legitimate instrument to hold money, to secure capital, to find yield outside of treasury bonds. I think both of those kind of landing in the same place at the same time is going to be a hell of a recipe for some bullishness.
I'll point out, one of the subtle things I think about Lightning is it is a very complex, sophisticated system. And the fact that there are engineers who can do that reliably and get this working in, frankly, a very short time period, even if you're not, say, buying into Bitcoin because you think Lightning matters, I think the smarter sort of institutional investors will go look at that and say, well, hang on, you know, there is mindshare there. There are very comp developers working on this system. You know, there are people who will keep pushing this forward. You know, when you compare like what it took to get Lightning working and what it took to get many of the other altcoins working, you know, there is no comparison. It's just, it's so much more sophisticated and just such better engineering. And I think that speaks a lot to Bitcoin itself, because those same people, if something needs to be done in Bitcoin, well, they're available, you know? And also, if something needs to be done to, say, hold your Bitcoins, well, those same kind of, that same kind of talent is available on Bitcoin. And, you know, yes, it may not matter to the price that, you know, people can go and, you know, buy all this stuff with Lightning. And, well, frankly, there is a lot of stuff you can go buy with Lightning these days, but that engineering talent matters.
Absolutely. And Bitcoin's able to attract the best in the world, because it matters, because it's the best in the world in terms of projects, cryptocurrency projects. So it's incredible listening to you guys talk about Bitcoin's history. It's absolutely fascinating. It's amazing what Bitcoin has accomplished in just 12 years. You know, this little project that was no one even spent anything on it for several days at the very beginning of the chain. You know, like there's a test transaction from Satoshi to another coder on the Cypherpunk mailing list. And, you know, these people are talking on IRC to develop this thing out, and no one really believes that it's anything that could seriously become what it is today. And so it's amazing. It's an amazing story. And we have the next 12 years are going to be equally amazing to watch. This year is going to be, like Guy said, I think a very bullish year for Bitcoin as well. And yeah, it's been fantastic. I really appreciate you guys' time.
Thank you.
Absolutely, man. Been great.